it's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Well, it was nice while it lasted. Positive goal difference, that is. Manchester United back to naught in goal difference and perhaps back to zero chance of finishing in the Premier League's top four after a late 2-1 defeat at home to Fulham, an ever so rare victory for the Cottagers at Old Trafford. This comes in a week of great excitement and hope for the club. So Jim Ratcliffe, Ineos and Trawlers Limited were confirmed as co-owners of United, bringing with them ambition, vision and relieving frankness as well. So despite the results, a very warm welcome to the Manchester United Weekly Podcast. I'm Harry Robinson. Jack Tate is with me as always. Thank you for joining us. As well as dissecting that Fulham defeat, we'll play guest to player, give you the academy briefing, consider Ratcliffe's early statements and how that fits into the historical context of Manchester United and its FA Cup week. United travel to Nottingham Forest on Wednesday night. Will Erik ten Hag have his Mark Robbins moment? We'll preview that game at the end of the episode. Let's begin. Jack, we're sat here recording on Sunday afternoon. I've got the very early stages of the EFL Cup final playing just to the side of me. It's remarkable, isn't it, to think back to roughly a year ago when we were in this final playing at Wembley Stadium and all of the hope that came with February 2023, defeating Barcelona over two legs, beating Newcastle to win a first trophy in 5 years, and everything seemed very rosy. Fast forward a year and once again there had been a little bit of stability and some good form and certainly some good results and some good moments, but that kind of hope and expectation that Ten Hag will be here longer than till the end of the season seems to decrease with that performance on Saturday afternoon.
Yeah, it all felt so different a year ago. Different not only to how it does now, but different to how it has done under previous managers when we've had little bits of false dawns. And yet I think this feels entirely familiar to anyone that's been following Man United for the last 6 or 7 years. It's the classic, you know, manager has an okay season, spends a lot of money in the transfer window, those transfers don't pan out, and then with a lack of identity, when results start not going your way, there's very, very little to hold on to at the club. And, you know, we'll get into more of the specifics of why we lost this game and how it came to be. But I think there's just a feeling of, I think almost a bit of hopelessness at how similarly things seem to be playing out under Ten Hag to how they have under previous managers. And probably the only sort of contrast to that is obviously the new ownership structure and the things we're hearing from Jim Ratcliffe do feel meaningly different, albeit it remains to be seen how that actually plays out on the pitch.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I think there's obviously a lot more certainty in terms of ownership now, and it's fantastic that that's gone through and we've got that certainty, and we've been waiting for it for nearly 2 years now. But there remains lots that is uncertain. The future of Old Trafford has dominated the headlines this week, but also the possibility of Erik ten Hag not being Manchester United manager beyond the end of this season. Add into that the furore around United's kind of sporting director or football director or director of football, whatever you want to call him, potentially Dan Ashworth if that happens. So there's all these still things that are still very uncertain and that are very, very significant to the short-term and long-term future of the club. So we've got that certainty, but there's still the others. And I think there is an interesting kind of contrast in emotions. See, for me, I don't feel that hopelessness because I'm pretty confident that maybe United won't win the league or the Champions League in 5 years' time, but I'm confident at least that the direction of progress will be upwards over the next couple of seasons, even if there's a few hurdles and bad periods along the way. So I don't, but I completely understand why, yeah, there is that. It's this kind of weird contrast. You're absolutely right. I thought this was interesting, and perhaps it was because it was the part of the stadium I was in for the first time. I'm normally, as regularly as you know, I normally stand above the tunnel in the Stretford End every so often due to the slightly weird nature of my season ticket. I'm in J stand as well, so the opposite corner. And this was the first time I was stood there since the Brentford game in October where Scott McTominay scored two goals to win it late on for United. So maybe that's, and it was a sunny Saturday 3 p.m. game, so maybe that's the only reason that I'm drawing this comparison. But I was standing there even in the first half and bits of the second half thinking this feels quite similar to Brentford in that United have been rubbish, but in those final 10 minutes we could have won it. And I maintain that. I think they're fairly similar. But this time, the chaotic kind of playing with fire football went against us. And if you're Erik ten Hag and this is the way you set your United team out, you have to take the rough with the smooth in that sense, or you have to change your style, which we'll get onto. But do you think the similarities with the Brentford game is a fair point, or is it just because I happen to be sitting in the same seats?
No, I think it is, especially the way the game ended. I think, to be honest, it's also not really that different to some of the games we've had recently. It felt... Yeah. To be honest, somewhat similar to the Spurs game at Old Trafford, where, you know, in that game, the only difference was we buried one of those early chances that we had, which, you know, if one of those Garnacho cold shots from the edge of the box after he had a few of them between sort of 25 and 35 minutes goes in, probably looking at a fairly similar game to how things played out against Spurs. This is what we've been saying for a few weeks now, despite the positive results, which have been fun, that, you know, United are always kind of living on a bit of a knife edge because we don't have... much, we're not creating sort of a buffer for ourselves in that the general level of our play is not that much better than any opposition that we face.
And so
things sort of have to go our way for us to win games. If I can explain this a different way, if you're comfortably better than the opposition you're facing in the way that you're playing, things can go against you and you'll still win just because of how dominant you are in the game. But yeah. United don't have that at the moment. And so if a couple of things don't go the way that we want them, we're screwed. And that, I don't really feel like that is what happened against Fulham necessarily. I don't think we didn't think we had bad luck or anything, but we're just not creating any sort of dominance in the game at any point. And we're just so open defensively.
Yeah. And for most of the recent games, we've kind of begun our conversations around them, even after winning against Luton and Villa, et cetera, saying, is this sustainable? Is this actually a sign of good form, or is this just it obviously is a sign of good form. Is this a true indicator of kind of improvement? And I think the answer has generally been no, but I can see why it's being successful for now.
Well, and also the entire time, like I go back a week, we asked about previewing the Fulham game. You asked me if I was confident, and my response has been our response whenever we've said, why are United winning these games, was, I'm confident we'll score goals with that front three.
Yes.
And obviously that front three couldn't play together now. And I don't think the reason we lost this game necessarily was because Højlund wasn't there, because our general play for getting that end of the pitch was terrible throughout. But it felt like we could play badly.
In fairness, I think we would have won the game with Højlund playing, but that's not... first of all, it's not an excuse, but also it's just not good enough. You can't be that reliant on your 20-year-old, 21-year-old centre forward who you didn't expect to play every game when you signed him.
And I think the thing with that front three is with how well they were playing was it allowed you to play quite badly and still be with a chance of winning games.
Yes. The probably most damning statistic and perhaps most representative statistic of the way that United are playing is the fact that we've now faced more shots on our goal in the Premier League this season, 435, than any other team except woeful Sheffield United, who have been spanked time and time again. And if you look at it just since the turn of the year, which is really when this slightly different style of play has emerged, very transition heavy, very chaotic, we're giving up, we're facing, and Arna is facing on average 20 shots per game. It's just, that's why we ask the questions about, is this sustainable? And at times against Fulham, we had 21 shots. Against Luton, we had 21. Against Villa, we had 17. Against Wolves, we had 21. So we are also having a lot of shots ourselves. But the nature of playing like that is sometimes you're going to win games in a tight way, like 4-3 at Wolves or 2-1 at Villa or 2-1 against Luton, et cetera, et cetera. Sometimes you're going to lose them.
It's been a statistic that I've heard floating around quite a lot in the last couple of weeks. And to be honest, it's quite surprising when you hear it, but then it does line up with everything that we're seeing week in, week out. I mean, this team just cannot stop opposition from getting into good positions, no matter who we play against. You know, it's not as if all of those shots are coming, you know, from a couple of games where we've been absolutely dominated. It is every single week, even in our good performances, teams are creating very, very good opportunities against us consistently. I, as strange as this is from that statistic and the fact that we've conceded a lot of goals this season, I actually think Andre Onana is having a fairly good season. He's not been amazing.
In the Premier League,
To be fair,
we had this conversation recently, didn't we? It's in the Premier League, he's generally been really good with a few questionable moments. It was in the Champions League where it was criminal. Yeah. I mean, not the only reason, but the main reason United aren't in European football anymore is a series of absolute howlers from him in European football.
But it's just, it's not something I think that you would ever expect from a team that is trying to reach, you know, the top three, top four of the table, that your goalkeeper could be having a fairly good season in the league and you've still conceded this many goals and this many shots. There's no resistance at all. And we talked about it last week. I can't remember if it was in the Patreon Q&A or in the main episode, but we said about how is this sustainable? And the comparison that we could sort of draw was the Real Madrid team from the mid-2010s that won all those Champions Leagues and did it despite not looking like a particularly great side, but they would find a way to win through some great moments by their really talented attackers, and they would have these backs to the wall performances where they could keep teams out despite being under constant pressure. And we said the only way that United can ever get close to replicating that is to somehow become very, very good defensively.
The kind of basic fact is if you want to play like this, you have to be really, really, really good at it. Whereas some other styles of play, you don't have to be like the best in the world in almost every position to have success with it, which United obviously aren't.
Yeah, I mean, if you try and play like that and you concede more than one goal, it becomes extremely, extremely difficult for you to win any games.
I saw some comments and heard a few people saying that there was kind of a lack of structure or lack of shape to United's team. And it's very easy for it to feel like that when you see a performance like that. But there was structure and shape. It's just one that probably, I think, we both disagree with. There was and it sounds mad because it is mad. There was a 2-1-7 formation in the first half and second half for quite a lot of the time. Two defenders back, Casemiro in the middle by himself, and then set a line of seven, not completely straight, a kind of curved line forward. But I'm lost for words because it's just really strange, and it crowds the talented players. It leaves massive gaps between kind of three parts of your team, defence, midfield and attack. It doesn't play to the strength of Bruno Fernandes because people are looking for his runs rather than him being able to look for their runs. It leaves Casemiro massively exposed. It leaves your centre-backs very exposed. It means when you do concede possession, which, I mean, any team will, but we are pretty bad at anyway, you're suddenly left with an emergency situation rather than, oh, it's okay, we've lost it, we're going to get it back. And what's frustrating is some performances we have had that ability to control things a little bit better and maintain and kind of have waves of attack we spoke about after the West Ham game. But generally, we're very much the opposite. And yeah, that space is, the space and setup was fairly baffling.
Yeah, I think my biggest issue with the setup was our right-hand side. So you play Forsen over Antony, which I don't have a problem with at all. I think Forsen deserved this chance and Antony clearly doesn't based on everything we've seen from him this year. So you have Dalot and Forsen on the right-hand side. Dalot was coming inside a lot, which is something we've seen fairly often over the last month or so. Going back to, I think it was the Newport game, the first time I noticed it really regularly. Dalot would come inside and try and be an extra body in midfield. That's fine. What I didn't understand was, you already have your right back pushing infield. Forsen was then also coming inside a lot, which I don't think was him sort of, you know, doing his own thing. That seemed like a concerted plan because there were times where he and Rashford
But that is very much his style of play. He's not a winger. And when he has played wide for...
No, I know that from when I've watched him in the U team, but when he and Rashford would switch momentarily, Rashford would do exactly the same. And so then you end up with both your players on the right-hand side are coming inside a lot. You've got no width on the right-hand side, which ends up meaning that so often the ball would get cycled out to Varane in the right centre-back spot. He's receiving the ball with Muniz or whoever else from Fulham's attacking line, closing him down from the centre of the pitch, forcing him wide. And where the normal pass that you'd play to either the right-back or the right-winger just isn't on because they're in central midfield. So then Varane is either getting dispossessed because he's not the greatest on the ball anyway, or he's having to go long to, in a team where we don't have a Hoyland type player up front that can actually win some of those duels. It was baffling to me what we were trying to do. I still now, I don't really understand what the plan was. And even I think Ten Hag's stance on Antony, I think is, as I said, I don't disagree with Antony being dropped now and going down the pecking order. But I think the way in which it's happened kind of speaks to Ten Hag's confusion. Antony was almost undroppable for months this season. And all of a sudden, it seems like he's gone from almost undroppable to fourth choice on the right side. Yeah. You know, Ahmed came on ahead of him yesterday. Yeah. Forson obviously started ahead of him. Garnacho's clearly ahead of him when everyone's fit. I have no problem with Antony being fourth choice, to make that clear. But how do you go from, I'm going to play you for 3 months straight, no matter what, how you perform, to there's actually three players suddenly ahead of you? It just speaks to a manager who is, for my money, kind of lurching from one thought to another without any real idea of a long-term plan of what he wants this team to be.
Which I think links to, I think, the general feeling of frustration and kind of disappointment, because as we were saying at the start, the League Cup final is on now. A year ago, we were in such a positive feeling about Ten Hag and about United and about this squad. A general feeling, and this goes back to when he was first appointed as well, that in Ten Hag we expected a really tactically astute manager who would not only be able to kind of put his own identity on this United team and improve the squad and the club, but would also be able to adapt. And I think we have seen some really good games from Ten Hag, but at the moment it's that frustration that yes, the injuries are really bad and really unfortunate and really disappointing, and whether there needs to be an improvement in terms of United's medical department or sports science or the way that they train is not for us, because we don't know what goes on behind the scenes. So we'd be speaking in an uneducated way. It's unfortunate, but you want to see some adaptability that can still generate good results. And the results we've seen recently have not, I don't think, been kind of incredible, surprising tactical plans that help United adjust best to this injury crisis that's been going on all season. And again, with Hoyland out, you didn't see anything like that. There was clear confusion. Rashford and Forson are very different players, so the idea that they can swap mid-game to any great effect is odd. The idea that the front three can play in quite a similar way to when Hoyland there is you're just left feeling at the end of games, is that all you could muster, Eric, really?
And little things like, if you want Rashford and Forson to switch, okay, but why would you then not put Rashford on the left and Garnacho on the right? Yeah. When we've seen in the last weeks that they both play much better there. There were long stretches of that game and we ended up with Rashford on the right, Garnacho on the left and Forson through the middle, which makes no sense really, based on everything that we've seen in the last few months.
Yeah, the system and the idea that Ten Hag is putting on this United team, as I've said, can create games and results like this. But you also then have individual moments when you see kind of senior players, leaders like Casemiro, who at one point seemed to try a back heel with only two defenders back, and suddenly Fulham attacked and Onana had to make a good save. And there is, again, of course, there's always nuance to all of these things, but there is that nuance to it, isn't it? That while we're left very uninspired by the way United are playing, there's also these moments of madness from senior players sometimes where you think, oh God, that's not helping either. And ultimately that comes down to the manager to stop that happening and create a system where it can't happen. Or if it does happen, then United can recover much better. But it is frustrating when you see moments like that.
Yeah, massively. And look, obviously this isn't all on Ten Hag. There's a lot of mistakes that got made by the players and have been made by the players all season, and they obviously need to take accountability for that. But it also shouldn't be the case that, as you said earlier about the sort of defensive structure that we have in this sort of 2-1-7, it shouldn't be the case that when Casemiro loses the ball, it's suddenly, I mean, there were at one point we had a four against two Fulham players running to our two defenders, and luckily they spurned the chance in the first half. I think it was on where Iwobi ran through and put it wide with his right foot. It shouldn't be that easy to get through us. And so, yes, you know, Casemiro shouldn't make that mistake, but the structure of our team should also be better, that he has better options when he gets the ball, and that if we lose it in midfield, it's not immediately that, you know, that hideous
situation.
For the man
who effectively introduced the term rest defence to English football, it's pretty extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I remember John McKenzie, our good friend, who's been on the podcast before, he loved how much Ten Hag mentioned rest defence when he first came to England, but I don't think he'd be very impressed with the actual rest defence that we're showing.
Yeah, it's an eclectic mix of tactical ideas, it seems. And then when you watch that as a fan who doesn't dedicate their time to kind of understanding all of that and leaves it to the professionals, it just looks like a mess. That's what it does. And it is a mess. What I think what we really need to know is, we kind of alluded to this last week, is this, does Ten Hag see this as a, I've got a load of injuries, I've not got all the players I wanted. Some of the players I wanted aren't as suitable to this, to the Premier League, as I thought, like Antony and Amrabat maybe. This is the best way I can think of to get results and success for United up to the end of the season. Is he thinking that, or is this his vision long-term for United? And if it's the latter, you're a lot more concerned than the former, aren't you? But we don't know that.
Yeah, 100%. I think there's three big questions that Ten Hag needs to answer. Two of them you just mentioned there. Is this sort of the end state that he imagines? Is this just something he's doing because of all the injuries and just to sort of get through this period? But then also, I think whatever the answer to those two is, if the answer is, actually, this isn't how I see this United team going eventually, I have other plans for how I want to see this team develop. I think the bigger question is also, is he the right man and is he capable of making the team get to the point that he wants it to get to? Because even if we think his ideas are right, if he doesn't show us any evidence that he's capable of actually coaching this team to that point, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, but for all of this, there is the kind of key quote of the week from Sir Jim Ratcliffe, which is when he was asked about Ten Hag's future and who would be manager, he said, we've seen lots of successful managers here, and when all of them don't succeed, you have to think it's the environment that's not right rather than the specific manager. And so that has to influence what we're thinking and saying for the rest of the season. So I'm still very much in the boat of see what Ten Hag can do before the end of the season. But yeah, it's not great. And what's that, there is determination there from these players, unlike when the Rangnick season fizzled out. And I don't think generally it's an effort problem at United. Maybe there's a lot of misguided effort, but that's different. But you saw 1-1, Anana, Bruno, Dallo, a few others kind of trying to get the crowd going. I hope this result doesn't pop that bubble and lead to a season fizzling out.
I was just going to say, I think if, especially if we lost to Forest in the FA Cup on Wednesday, yeah, I think then it's that a problem. It could happen.
Yeah. I'm also thinking that another period's just come to mind, the Van Gaal time when we had a lot of injuries, but he managed to bring young players into the side and get fantastic results. Players who
didn't make it. We won at the Emirates, didn't we? With a back three of, like, I think it was Smalling, Blackett and McNair with Ashley Young at left back.
Yeah. And then obviously we also won at Old Trafford in when Rashford scored his double. But I think why it's relevant is that most of those young players who came in, I mean, a few of them were medium term. Rashford was obviously long term. For some of them, it was one or two games they played and that was it. But he made it work. And that's kind of what you want from Ten Hag at the moment. And that's not really what we're getting.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Right, let's have Guess the Player clue one. Three clues during the show. United player or staff member past or present. And I'm setting the clue for you, Jack, this week. And your first clue is, I made my Manchester United debut age 17 in 1971.
Oh, okay. Well, we're looking, I guess, right at the end of the Busby era. I mean, I'll definitely need more clues, but helpful to know the time frame that we're looking at.
Yeah.
All right.
Yep. Yeah. Okay. A final few things on the Fulham game. Amari Forson's debut was hard.
Yeah, I felt, to be honest, I felt a bit sorry for him. at times during the game. Like I said, he was actually taking up some quite good positions in the middle of the pitch. There were countless times where Maguire or Casemiro would have the ball and Forson was picking up some good spaces in between the lines, wanting them to kind of fizz the ball into him so he could receive it on the half turn and play forward or lay it off to Bruno Fernandes. And he just wasn't receiving the ball almost every time. And I said, I listened to Paul Merson after the game as well, and he was saying the same thing, that he felt Forson was let down by senior players. And I tend to agree, to be honest. I just don't think he was ever really given a realistic chance to thrive in that game because of the way that we played. Now, yeah, you could say, you know, that really, really good young players find a way to look good in short moments. But I think the kind of player that Forson is, he's not a Garnacho-type winger that's about sort of dribbling and beating your man, where it's very easy to stand out even in a couple of moments in a game. That isn't the type of player that Forson is. And so I was watching, I could see him getting frustrated as the first half wore on. He got a little bit more involved as we had a decent, you know, 10 minutes or so before the end of the first half. But I felt like I was just watching a player who understandably was getting annoyed with teammates because he didn't feel like he was his sort of good in the ability that he had wasn't being allowed to be showcased.
Yeah. And that kind of links to the point we're making about thinking back to that Van Gaal time, where the advice he gave to Rashford when he played was just stick between the posts and see what you can do. Whereas with Forson, he had like two or three different roles in this game. It was complicated and didn't play to his strengths. And you just thought, I kind of understood if he was going to play centrally and then Ten Hag was creative and made United play differently because Forson's such a different build and style of player to Højlund. But that's not really what happened. So yeah, I did feel sorry for him. He was fine. It wasn't great.
What was strange to me was that, like, Dallow's role has really changed since Garnacho has come into the team on the right. And I don't know if that's causation there. I don't know if his role has changed because Garnacho's been playing on the right or if those two separate things happened at the same time. But when Anthony was in the team, Dallow would stay much wider and he tried to offer that overlapping run, which is great because when you've got a winger that comes inside, he's going to create all that space. It then seems like we've shifted away from that with Garnacho playing on the right. Dallow's come inside more, again, makes sense. And it just felt like we didn't shift back when we had Forson, who obviously, again, different type of player to Anthony, but at the same time takes up some fairly similar-ish positions. His starting position is much more central than Anthony tends to start wide and then bring the ball inside, whereas Forson just stays inside more. But we just needed Dallow on the outside, giving him a bit of an option and giving us a better option when we had the ball in defence and deep in midfield. It just felt a little bit confused. Like I backed the decision to start Forson. It just felt like we didn't adjust. Like you were saying, we didn't adjust the way we're playing to suit what he was trying to do.
Yeah, agreed. Okay, let's talk the other side of things at Manchester United this week. By
the way, before we move off the Fulham game, just quickly, I was very impressed with the performance up front for Fulham of Muniz.
Yeah,
really good. I think United could do a lot worse than him as a backup striker. I'm sure he'd be massively overpriced buying someone from inside the Premier League, but he was on loan at Middlesbrough last season, I think, sort of come out of nowhere, and he's keeping Broha out of the team there now. I thought he was really, really good.
Yeah, yeah. Probably the only other thing to say, Ahmad was fairly bright when he came on, and I'd expect him to start against Forest now.
Yeah.
Which would be good, because it'd be lovely to see what he can do. Yeah, let's talk about the other side of things. So Jim Ratcliffe's becoming co-owner of United has been confirmed. He's many interviews were generally very positive, I thought. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think it was a lot of good stuff, a lot of what we want to hear, really.
Yeah, yeah. He knows the right things to say. He's got a very good PR team, and Paddy Harverson, who was Director of Communications at United in the early 2000s and later worked with the Royal Family, is involved in that. So it's little surprise that the right things are coming across. That being said, I was with someone who works for United this week who has spoken to Ratcliffe a few times and also spoke to representatives from the other bidders, the Qataris, but also Elliott Group and a couple other hedge funds and various other bidders right at the very early stages. And he said that the only bidder present who he chatted to who asked questions about football rather than legal or financial things was Ratcliffe. And this was about 2 years ago, and that he made a very positive impression. So yeah, only had good things to say. I think a lot of it is authentic, to be fair. And even if it isn't fully authentic, and if he's been told to say it, I always maintain I would rather, even if it's not fully authentic, I would rather someone at least trying to engage with supporters even if they have to kind of put it on a bit, because it shows that they realise the importance of that, which is the opposite to the Glazers. But I do think most of it is authentic. Yeah, all sounding good and exciting. And while I disagree with certain things, and we can talk a little bit about Old Trafford, you just want to hear that ambition and vision and kind of, yeah, big vision of things for the future. I referenced it a little bit last week and a few times since takeoff has happened. But again, the similarities between him and James Gibson from the 1930s are mad. Like, you compare the two quotes that came out from Ratcliffe now and from Gibson back in December 1931. Gibson said, "I want to place Manchester United on a level with the great teams of the country. I want covered accommodation at Old Trafford." Ratcliffe said, "Just the beginning of our journey to take United back to the top of English, European and world football with world-class facilities for our fans." Kind of the immediate mission mission statement or goals is better facilities for fans and success. Two men promising the same things 92 years apart. So it's strange. Were there any concerns that you might have had reading some of the quotes?
Yeah, a couple. I think the answer on the women's team that he gave in the interview with The Athletic felt like a little bit of a throwaway. Didn't seem like it was something that he'd thought too much about. He just sort of said if they're wearing a United shirt, they should be winning. And it didn't seem like he knew all too much about that. And there's, I think, just the general concern, as we said, about how authentic and real is this. But, you know, I think you've got to give... I think coming in, I give him the benefit of the doubt. And to be fair, I think his history helps with that. Like, I think I probably have and am more willing to give him the benefit of the doubt than I would be if it was someone who came in and had no historical attachment to the club at all. You know, Jim Ratcliffe is far removed from the boy that grew up in Failsworth at this point. But I think that does help. And the fact that he grew up a United fan, it helps, I think, give me some confidence that he should get it at least to some degree.
I think I think he does. He was chatting to this guy that I was speaking to about buying the football pink when he was a kid outside Old Trafford and coming with his dad. I think there is that genuine authenticity there. What happened between the ages of like 15 and 71?
Yeah,
obviously.
Exactly.
The cynic would say, "You're so rich, you could easily have come to every United game. Why were your Chelsea season ticket holder?" But to be honest, I'm not too bothered about that. If over the next few years we see it's the best interest of the club at heart, and I don't think they're here for financial reasons, which is what he's saying. I think they're here to see what they can do, and he's a 71-year-old man who's been very successful and now can really challenge himself, which is what Ineos have been doing in the sporting sense for a long time. There's also the aspect of greenwashing, which has not yet been covered massively. I think is a valid thing to raise. Also, his actions with trade unions, also valid things to raise. But in terms of Old Trafford, again, that's kind of where the big vision really was coming across. And it's interesting, I thought his comments seemed to have turned the tide entirely on Old Trafford. Suddenly lots of people who favoured a renovation now wanting a new build, which I understand, but I would say bear in mind kind of why he's saying that or why it might happen. That the kind of the downside of a powerful single owner is that they can want to do things for themselves and have the power to do it. And that can be a great thing. John Henry Davies, the president from the early 1900s, wanted a legacy for United and for himself. He built Old Trafford. It's an undoubted good thing. But at the time, United were moving further than any Football League club ever had, 5 miles across town. And the old supporters from United and Newton Heath were very unhappy at that. And they were left behind and they could no longer go to games. So things can look very good in historically, but at the time they will piss fans off. And I think the Ratcliffe seems to want a physical legacy and quickly, which is great. The ambition is fantastic, but I hope that the possibility of an improved and renovated Old Trafford isn't just thrown out the window because he wants this physical legacy of his own. Because I still favour a renovated Old Trafford. I don't know if your opinions have changed over this week.
I don't look badly on anyone who's saying that they do want a new Old Trafford completely redone, but I've been a bit surprised at how quickly that shift has happened this week. Like, to me,
exactly.
To me, it's quite simple, to be honest. I want the best stadium that we can possibly get for Man United, and that means both the sort of very tangible things like attendance, the facilities, how the stadium looks, the match day experience that fans get, combined with the atmosphere that it generates, the history that it holds, the character that it has. And so
it's a fine balance.
Yeah. And basically the way I look at it is a new stadium, it can generate its own history and character, but it's never immediately going to have the history and the lore that Old Trafford does. So for me, for a brand new stadium to be worth it, it has to be significantly better than what a renovated Old Trafford could be.
Yeah.
And if it can do that, then I think that might make it worth it. And I understand that renovating Old Trafford, because of its location, there are a lot of limitations that we have to work around. But like, if you offered me the choice of two fairly similar stadiums, one being brand new, maybe in the middle of all the land that United own, versus a renovated Old Trafford in the same location, in the same building, but renovated, and those two were fairly similar standard, I would go with the renovated Old Trafford every time.
Yeah, it was a point I was making last week. If you're going to build a new stadium, do it proper, 120,000 people. Again, all this talk of 90,000 just baffles me. That's the attendance. Sorry, that's the capacity that United should be at now if we had carried on at the rate we were going, which stopped when the Glazers arrived. The last renovation proper kind of changes to Old Trafford were done in 2006, but that project had begun before the Glazers took over and they just let it continue. United would be at 90,000 now. So you have to future-proof it and blow every other European club out of the water. I think that's basically Barcelona. Can you build it bigger than Barcelona? So if the difference is, we can have 120,000 in a new stadium and it'll be amazing, or we can have 85,000 at Old Trafford, that's where it becomes a much more difficult decision for me. Not that my opinion is going to change it, but that's when personally it becomes more of a harder kind of hypothetical to think about, because anything, an extra 35,000 people being able to come to the game every week, that's a proper decision.
I was just saying, I think it's worth remembering that when the Glazers came in and this renovation of Old Trafford, the expansion was finished to make it the capacity that it is now. At that time, Old Trafford was almost 25,000 bigger than any other stadium in the Premier League.
Yeah.
That gap now is more like 12, 13,000 because Old Trafford's capacity has been reduced a little bit to improve some accessibility access. And then also stadiums like Spurs and Arsenal being built, Anfield being expanded.
Yeah.
Old Trafford should be at minimum, I would say, 20 to 25,000 more than any other stadium in the Premier League. We can fill that stadium every single week.
Yeah. Yeah, agreed. I think the plans over the last few years that have been spoken about in terms of renovation for the South Stand has been to build a new South Stand with three tiers, but going straight up. So we spoke a bit about last week, if you could build over the railway line, that's my grand idea for Old Trafford, is to have a station kind of running underneath the South Stand. But I think the plans have been to build straight up and have a stand at Old Trafford, which they have at many other clubs, where the lower tier is the roof of the second tier is over the lower tier, which you don't really have apart from at the very back of each stand at Old Trafford. So yeah, that could help get to 90,000, and then you need to widen the concourses and you need to create Ed Woodward's dream Manchester United world around it. But yeah, so at least it's been spoken about. It's all positive. I hope it doesn't stop either, and I don't think it will.
And to be fair, I think to the point you were saying before about, you know, this doesn't seem like Ratcliffe is here to make money. I completely agree, and I think this is testament to it, because if he was here to put in as little money as he can and just make as much as he can on this investment, you would not be floating. And it seems like he is slightly favouring the option to build a brand new stadium. It's going to cost £1 billion more than renovating Old Trafford.
Yeah, some suggestion that I haven't actually seen these quotes, that he said a new build will only be possible with some external funding, which makes sense. He's obviously been talking about government loans. We mentioned that a little bit last week, and we can talk about that again in future. But and that if not, then it would have to be a renovation, which would be fine by me. Cheaper. And I'd be very sad to leave Old Trafford, as I think many people would.
I also just think in terms of the renovation versus new build thing, if you look at stadiums that have been, like, where clubs have moved, let's say Tottenham, Arsenal with Highbury and now Everton with Goodison Park going, they were stadiums where not only were the facilities not very good, but the actual sort of the bones and the foundations of those stadiums were very, very old. And like, if you imagine trying to rebuild Goodison Park, like, Goodison Park was an ancient stadium in almost all ways, and it had a lot of charm because of that. But Old Trafford isn't like that. The actual, most of Old Trafford, the sort of structure itself, is fairly modern, especially the design of it.
In fairness, I think a lot of the internal infrastructure is very old. It is an Edwardian building. So yes, a lot of the stands have been, but like the piping and the wiring, which are obviously not the key issues for a football stadium, but they are important, have apparently become a lot harder to manage and upkeep because of the neglect since the Glazers came in. So that is one thing worth bearing in mind. But I agree. And the other point with those stadiums is White Hart Lane was, the contrast between the two is so enormous. Whereas for Old Trafford's faults, it's still an incredible stadium. So I don't think the jump up would be quite as big. But yeah, we better move on unless there's anything urgent else. Guess the player clue two. Your first one was, I made my United debut age 17 in 1971. Your second clue is, I'm known as the last Busby Babe. I am known as the last Busby Babe.
Oh, okay.
Any guesses or do you want to mull it over?
All right. I reckon I'll have a guess before the next clue.
Okay. We're going to dive into an ad break for normal listeners and Patreon Q&A for our patrons.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes.
Chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Time for the Academy Briefing. The under-18s extended their league unbeaten run to 17 games with a 15th victory of the campaign, putting three past Middlesbrough at home in a confident performance. They managed to keep a clean sheet by having two goalkeepers on the pitch at once. Cameron Byrne-Hughes was forced to come on as an outfield player late on due to injury, which was a pretty incredible thing to see. United's goals came from James Scanlon, Ashton Missin and Ethan Wheatley. Missin's goal, United's second, was wonderful, beautiful footwork to dance past a couple of players and finish into the bottom right corner, certainly worth a watch. Last Monday, United beat Manchester City 2-1 in Premier League 2. Tom Huddleston scored the winner, which was incredible from the player coach. And Toby Collier got his first involvement in a United matchday squad against Fulham. He was an unused sub, as you would have seen. Collier is a midfielder who once captained England's youth sides. He joined United from Brighton just after his 18th birthday in March 2022. He was born in January 2004 and has been a regular for the under-21s since he moves the ball well. There was no involvement for any of the young fullbacks, despite some predictions in the press. Harry Amass is the 16-year-old in the headlines. He joined from Watford last summer. He's doing really well in the under-18s for whom he played on Saturday, but it's definitely too early for him to be involved in the first team. He's not yet played for the under-21s even, but he is in first team training more regularly now, as is the other fullbacks, Habib Ogunyai, who grew up in Bolton. He's been at United since he was a kid. He used to sprint when he was younger, and you can see that in his play. He's rapid and he can create a lot more often from right back than left back. Very rarely played at left back. And the final option and the oldest is James Nolan, who did play at left back against Stockport County in the EFL Trophy. So could be a possibility at some point if needed. Coming up this week, the under-21s play Derby County at Lee Sports Village on Friday evening in Premier League 2 at 7 p.m. kickoff. And the under-18s have a semi-final, the under-18 Premier League Cup semi-final at Carrington on Saturday morning, 11 a.m. kickoff. And both of those games will be shown live on MUTV if anyone wants to watch. Jax, just before we talk about Nottingham Forest quickly on Wednesday night, guess the player clue three.
I'll text you.
Unless you want to give me a guess after the first two clues, which were, I made my United debut age 17 in 1971 and I'm known as the last Busby Babe. So you're going to give me your clue, but I will read clue three for everyone else, which is, I captained Northern Ireland at the 1986 World Cup. I captained Northern Ireland at the 1986 World Cup, and will reveal the answer right at the end of the show in about 3 or 4 minutes' time. But first, Nottingham Forest on Wednesday, Jack. not confident, but it'd be so good, so useful. A cup run is exactly what this team and the manager needs, just like in 1990 for Sir Alex.
Yeah, I mean, speak about going back to this time last year and United playing in the Carabao Cup final. I mean, it was Forest who we played in the semi-final there too. Rashford and Weghorst scored, in fact, didn't they? Weghorst got his goal.
Surely not. Weghorst doesn't score goals.
it's funny how things sort of seem like they come full circle to some degree, because it feels like, despite being a much earlier stage of the competition, a very, very important game for our season. Like, I think I don't want to get too ahead of myself, but if you lose against Forest and then go into the Manchester Derby next weekend, you talked about, you know, this doesn't feel like the end of the Ranić season where the life has sort of been sucked out of the players. I think it could quite quickly. Yeah. If you end up in a position where you're 11 points off the top four, all right, fifth might get you into the Champions League, but I think at that point we'd still be eight-ish, something like that, points off of Spurs if they win as well.
Also, it's looking like fifth might not get you in the Champions League as well.
Yeah, I think we're still the favourites, but it got a bit closer.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, the season could quickly come off the rails. And I think there is a worry that this group of players, you know, they seem to be a little bit more professional, I guess, than I think some past Man United squads, but there's still enough players that have been part of teams like that in the past where you worry about the rest of the season becoming a real slog. And so I think this is a massively important game.
I hope that protecting against that will be the fact that the new co-owners have come in and said very clearly, we're watching you. They had a meeting with United's players, I can't remember how long ago, but soon after Christmas, which the players described as interesting, because I think they basically went in, I imagine this was Dave Brailsford and a couple others, and said, we know what world class looks like. We're going to be watching and seeing whether you're world class. So they laid it out. I hope the fact that there's kind of higher powers, even if Ten Hag's future isn't that certain, will make sure that that doesn't happen. But you're absolutely right. Defeat to Forest and then City would make it pretty hard for that not to happen. Forest, we won't talk about City yet, but Forest, a couple of quick ones. Would you start? We've just been talking in the Patreon Q&A about what's needed short term to make this United team better. And your main point was keeping Rashford on the left and Garnacho on the right to make sure that they have as best a chance as possible of performing well. So with that in mind, would you start Ahmad after a bright substitute performance against Fulham, or would you put, as you suggested, McTominay up front and have Rashford on the left and Garnacho on the right?
I think I would go with McTominay. Honestly, I really do. As a striker who isn't going to look to run in behind really, but will just come to feet, try and receive the ball, link up the play and create some space in behind for Garnacho and Rashford. To me, that feels like our only reliable route to go is to get those two in behind and running at players. I don't think that will happen. And if it doesn't, and we're going to play Rashford up top, then yeah, I would want Ahmad on the right and Garnacho on the left.
Yeah, agreed. I don't know which I'd prefer, but yeah. You just put, yeah. Any confidence?
I mean, I'm not happy with either option really, but I just think, as we said in the Patreon Q&A, I just think Garnacho and Rashford are the only two reliable goal threats that we have. And my priority without Hoyland in the team would always be to make sure that those two can maximise that goal threat as much as possible.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. We should be beating Forest. They're not in any kind of stunning form. They lost to Aston Villa this weekend. They did beat West Ham last week, but I think that's their only victory since the third round of the FA Cup, when they beat Blackpool on a replay. They did beat Bristol City in the cup, but on penalties after two draws. So on the other hand, we played them just about 6 weeks ago at the City Ground and were beaten in a pretty torrid performance. So
the City Ground is the kind of place where it's not the most raucous atmosphere United will go to, but it's the kind of place where if you give Forest a sniff, it will quickly ramp up. And that's what we've done when we've played them. Even going back actually to the semi-final last year, they had the goal from Awoniyi that was ruled out for a really marginal offside. And before Rashford went on that amazing solo run, we did let them in the game far too much. And we let the crowd really get into it. And we made it difficult for ourselves. But I think if this is the kind of place, if you go and you start fast and you control the game, even if you don't manage to get an early goal, I think you go a long way to winning the game.
Yeah. I was just running through kind of thoughts in my head and I was thinking, I was wondering whether I was going to predict United to lose to Forest and beat City. But no, I'm not going to. I'm not confident we'll win either game.
If this was back in the Solskjaer days, I would be right there with you. But
yeah, that's true. Yeah, absolutely. Maybe with this kind of Ole style football that we've been playing, we will beat City. But I don't think so. I think we'll get beaten.
I mean, we did finally beat a top half side away from home against Villa. So
I would
maybe
go,
this will be
we'll
it.
Lose to City 4-1, and confidently I'll go for 3-2 win at Forest, and it will be it'll feel like a season changing moment, and then we'll get spanked by City. So to end on that positive note, we will wrap things up. But guess the player. With the three clues, I captained Northern Ireland at the 1986 World Cup. I was the last Busby Babe after making my debut age 17 in 1971. Jack, reveal your guess and the answer.
My guess is Sammy McElroy.
Absolutely. Yes, Sammy McElroy. Lovely man. Great United career. And yeah, the last Busby Babe and great for Northern Ireland. Then went into management. Managed Morecambe for 6 years, I think. Got them promoted at least once.
I've got to say, I'm glad the Northern Ireland clue wasn't earlier because whenever I think of Northern Ireland and the Busby era, I just immediately think of Harry Gregg. I can't think of anyone else.
Lucky I didn't say 1958 World Cup. Although Harry Gregg wasn't captain, but he did play. As with Jackie Blanchflower, if he hadn't been injured in the Munich air disaster. And on that note, because it's come up, I did a piece for United Review this week, which was about the aftermath of Munich, not on the clubs. Not everyone knows about the FA Cup run after we beat Sheffield Wednesday and got to the final and were beaten there by Bolton, but what was the impact after Munich on the reserves and the A team and England and Wales and Scotland and Northern Ireland and Ireland, which was fascinating to look at. And the kind of butterfly effect of it all is incredible, because like Busby should have managed Scotland but was too ill to do so. Scotland ended up finishing bottom, I think. Jackie Blanchflower can play for Northern Ireland because he was injured. Bobby Charlton wouldn't have been in that England squad most likely, but Duncan Edwards and Tommy Taylor would have been, and Roger Byrne. But also you get little things like United took Jack Crompton, who just joined Luton Town as chairman. Crompton, who was goalkeeper in United's 1948 cup winning team, took Crompton back to become trainer on kind of an emergency deal to work alongside Jimmy Murphy. The person that replaced him was a guy called Sid Owen, who was a player, a centre half. He stepped up to become player coach, then became a coach properly very soon after, worked for Leeds for ages, then joined United, where having become this coach because of what happened after Munich, then was a massive influence on Mark Hughes when he was coming through United's academy setup. So yeah, the whole butterfly effect of it is amazing. Anyway, that's a random note to end on, and a more positive one than us losing a couple of games. Anyway,
then we'll lose 4-1 to City.
Yeah, just remind everyone. For more from you throughout the week, Jack, where can people find you on Twitter?
At UTDTate, CAIT.
And you can find me at Harry Robinson 64 on the podcast itself at UTD Weekly Pod. Thank you very much for listening, everyone. Have a great week, despite United's failings at the weekend. Have a good week. Goodbye.
Network.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right, ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumba. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It's time for today's Lucky Land horoscope with Victoria Cash.
Life's gotten mundane, so shake up the daily routine and be adventurous with a trip to Lucky Land. You know what they say, your chance to win starts with a spin. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com to play over 100 social casino-style games for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.